Welcome to the CSIS podcast, a look at the week's news in foreign policy through the eyes of the Centre for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Colm Quinn. On the show this week, we'll be talking about Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister who married stagecraft with statecraft on his visit to America. But first to Hong Kong, where the humble umbrella has become a sign of revolution. With thousands on the streets of the city out protesting, I sat down with Bonnie Glazer, Senior Advisor at CSIS, to find out what's happening.
Well, when the Chinese took back control of Hong Kong from the British in 1997, they agreed that the chief executive in Hong Kong would be chosen by a 1,200-member selection committee. And there was a promise made that eventually Hong Kong would have universal suffrage. And so a step forward towards a one-man, one-vote system was taken on August 31st, when in China, the National People's Congress Standing Committee made a decision to put in place a system for 2017 in the next round when a new chief executive would be elected. And the decision basically said that there would still be a committee that would have to approve, or at least half the members of the committee would have to approve, the slate of candidates. So everybody in Hong Kong in 2017 would be allowed to have a vote over the age of 18, one-man, one-vote system. But the person that they would vote for, or the two or three candidates, would basically still have to be approved by Beijing. And so this really caused a large number of particularly young people to want to express their opposition to this system rather than going forward with full democracy, deciding who would be able to actually run for the position of chief executive. So many people took to the streets over a course of the last month and swelled in the last few days to very, very large numbers.
And I suppose one of the main catalysts for this was the police response, trying to disperse protesters with tear gas in some instances. But then on the other hand, in the last couple of days, you've seen some conciliatory movements from the chief executive of Hong Kong to talk, at least by proxy, to these protesters. Do you think Beijing has handled this well?
Well, from China's point of view, there has only been one possible outcome, and that was the peaceful disbursement of the protesters, if they could be persuaded to disperse. And if not, the use of pressure from the police, not necessarily military violence. Probably they would not bring in the People's Liberation Army. But Hong Kong has a very large police force. It's about 28,000. And they have riot gear, and they are skilled in dispersing protesters. So initially they did use pepper spray and also tear gas. Many of the protesters put up umbrellas in order to protect themselves from the pepper spray. And so this later became dubbed the Umbrella Revolution. But China, I think, has never considered from the beginning until now the potential for making concessions. The protesters are demanding the removal of the chief executive, Long, and they would also, in addition, like to have a real democratic system, so they want real political reform. China will not allow the removal of the chief executive. This would have very negative implications potentially for other areas in China where they fear that Tibet, Xinjiang, even main cities in China like Beijing and Shanghai could launch protests that would demand political reform in China. This is something that the Chinese learned in 1989 when there were the Tiananmen protests. This is too risky. So the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party is at stake. And I think that the Chinese so far have handled it well in the sense that they have clearly signaled that they will not tolerate anything less than the protesters going back to their normal lives, abiding by this decision that was made on August 31st, and to continue the process of political reform in Hong Kong slowly.
But I mean, even in the sense that the protesters were listened to by someone in power in Hong Kong, who I guess derives his power from Beijing. You're on the mainland. If you're a mainland, you're mainland China, and you're looking at this, surely you're going to get some sort of hope, that if you do something similar, we may get a concession too, or we might at least get listened to. Do you think that there's a danger there from Beijing's eyes, or a potential there from the people's eyes in China?
I think there is such a danger if there are real concessions that are made. So far, the chief executive has said that his government, and basically has assigned his deputy to talk to some of the protesters. The protest in Hong Kong doesn't really have a center. It doesn't have a leader. It's very fragmented. And so no one person or even two or three people can represent the protesters. So this is also a problem in negotiating any solution. But I really think that the leadership in Beijing and represented by those in power in Hong Kong are not really negotiating. They are essentially waiting out the protesters. They are hoping that as time passes, people in Hong Kong who are not protesting, older generation businesses who are worried about tourists who won't come in, they will lose their money. Other people who want to see return to order and stability in Hong Kong will eventually prevail, that they will urge these students to cease this protest, because it really is creating a freezing effect on the operation of normal business in Hong Kong.
So do you think it's a generational thing?
Well, to some extent, it is generational. We look at photos of these students on the streets in Hong Kong. Most of them are young. Occasionally, you do see some older people. But this is the majority really are quite young. Some of them as young as teenagers who may not even be able to vote, although perhaps by 2017 they will have already turned 18. These are the people who are impatient for change in Hong Kong. They want to have a real democracy sooner. The reality is that China's decision is not a violation of the commitment that it made in 1997 when it took control of Hong Kong. It promised universal suffrage. It is moving towards freer democracy. Even the People's Daily Today in China said that this is a step toward real universal suffrage. So this is not an endpoint. China must recognize that these young people are going to be in Hong Kong in the future in positions of power. I think they don't want to completely alienate them. But I do think that the older people in Hong Kong see this decision by China as a step forward. After all, under British rule, Hong Kong was not a democracy. The people of Hong Kong did not have the right to vote. And so the Chinese haven't violated their commitment. Hong Kong doesn't have a history of having been a democracy and now being less than a full democracy. So this is moving in a direction where I think the people in Hong Kong disagree about how fast it should go. And not surprisingly, the youth are really the most impatient.
And that was Bonnie Glazer. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi wowed the crowds in America this week and seemed more rock star than politician on his visit. I talked to Rick Rossow, our resident India expert, to assess the trip and what it is that makes Modi different.
Well, for one thing, how pragmatic he is. You know, going back to 2005, the United States revoked his visa to travel to the United States. When it was apparent he was going to be elected in India's leader, there was a lot of question and head-scratching in the United States over whether or not we could restart relationship with Modi or whether we would be held in freeze for some time. And he proved to be a pragmatic leader. He knows there's things he needs for his country that the United States can provide, whether it's defense or business. And so he made the decision to come here quickly. So that, right off the bat, was a great sign. But his arrival, I mean, you talk about the groups that he proactively reached out to. He reached out to the U.S. government, of course, to the business community in a much stronger fashion than either of his predecessors had done. He reached out to the diaspora and had a sold-out event at Madison Square Garden. But most interestingly, I think, is how he reached out directly to the American public. The speech that he gave at Central Park, which some people overlook, 60,000 American youths, all of them active on social media, and there to talk about the same issues that Modi talks about every single day back in India. And with Modi's dominant presence on social media, too, there's an opportunity for him to connect with Americans even outside of government and business in a way that no previous leader had done, perhaps since Nehru.
Over the course of the trip, obviously a lot of announcements were made and a lot of connections were made, like you were talking about. Do you think that the India and the U.S. come away both happy from this?
I think they came away very happy. You look at the joint statement compared to past joint statements, and it's a lot less pretentious. There's no high-minded policies involved. It's real pragmatic things that one side has a strong interest and the other has an opportunity to provide. So whether it's on infrastructure finance, whether it's on joint cooperation on global warming, things like that, you really do see some areas where there's real potential for joint collaboration between the United States government and the Indian government. So I think both sides will walk away from this feeling that they got something that they didn't have the day before. And if nothing else, repairing the relations, which in the last 6 months or so had really declined because of a series of short-sighted economic decisions made from India, the arrest of a diplomat up in New York. So reparation of relations also was repairing the relations was also a critical element of this trip.
We saw that with President Obama taking an extra day even with Modi and visiting the Martin Luther King Memorial with him. Is this a sign that we're going to see a tighter relationship even just between these two leaders?
I think that's yet to be determined right now. Really, the United States is pulled in so many directions. There are a lot of crises in the world, and India is not the root of a crisis in any of them. Nor has India shown much willingness in the past to actually be part of the solution for these crises, whether it's Ebola, whether it's the rise of terrorism in West Africa. But to that point, you actually did see West Asia. But to that point, you actually did see a real reset in terms of the areas of the globe that the United States and India have committed to cooperate, at least to share information on. In this joint statement, you saw references to Syria, to Iraq, to North Korean nukes, and also to the South China Sea. So the areas of engagement on the globe has expanded dramatically. So if India becomes part of the solution to some of these problems, because luckily it has never been part of the problem along those lines, then you may get more high-level attention in a sustained manner from President Obama and other senior policymakers.
And looking from an India point of view at Modi and what he's trying to achieve there, it seems like India is always threatening to be, you know, the next big thing, the next big economic powerhouse. Do you think he can deliver that?
I think he can. You saw the last government in India, which had very little focus on the economy, bring 10% growth over multiple years. Despite the fact these big reforms that we consistently talk about, whether it's a goods and services tax, whether it's increasing FDI caps in critical sectors, even without those things being done, the last government, which didn't put the economy as its first order of business, managed to squeak out 10% growth. I think Modi, with his track record in Gujarat and with his focus on the economy, I think 10% will shortly become the new floor. I think business continues to sit back and wait, as they say in the policy circles, for big reforms to get done. But if you talk to business leaders in the country itself, they'll say the small reforms, the fact that a license got done faster, the fact that environmental clearances are moving more quickly, the fact that you don't have tax assessors coming and knocking on their door every single day, this is the real bricks and mortar stuff that makes business work, and it's getting better already, and it's expected to continue to get better under Modi. So, everybody keeps their eye on the big picture and the big reforms, but actual business environment has improved dramatically, and you're seeing that already. The numbers are going only in one direction so far. Foreign direct investment this year is up 47% over last year, and foreign institutional investment is up almost three times what it was all of last year. So the numbers are pointing in a very strong direction. I think policy sometimes is lagging a little bit behind.
And you wrote this week about how you're impressed with Modi himself and that he is engaging these business leaders directly, which is a departure from the past.
You're exactly right. In the past, to engage India on business issues, we had to come up with these strange artificial constructs. We have this U.S.-India CEO forum where American CEOs and Indian CEOs sit down together and come up with joint statements with the hopes that Indian CEOs we'll take these joint statements home and work on them on a daily basis. And I don't think any CEO is going to spend their precious time with senior officials working on joint statement type issues. We also had a number of constructs where the U.S. government was supposed to be the main interlocutor with the Indian government on economic issues. And that's one step removed from the people that actually make the decisions to invest. So the fact that Modi, he did a roundtable with CEOs, he did a roundtable with Indian American executives, he did one-on-one meetings with CEOs, And he gave a big rousing speech as his going away present at the U.S.-India Business Council just before getting on the plane. His engagement is direct. It's pointed. He understands he has to do certain things to get that investment. So direct engagement, I think, will have a better chance of yielding the kind of outcomes he wants, which is investment, which is jobs.
And you touched upon at the start how he'd engaged the American people and how this was kind of a departure from the past also. Do you think with his forced personality be able to bring a better understanding between the two countries?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, we all say that the India environment, the India relationship tends to be guided really just by government and business. The average public across the United States probably doesn't have much of at least a modern updated opinion of India. They'll think of yoga and monkeys and elephants, or they'll think of outsourcing and the loss of American jobs. But actually, there's a whole lot that we do with India in a wide range of areas of education, of energy and cleaning the environment. But also, if you look to the future, you know, 20 or 30 years from now, you know, Asia, there's a lot of concern about what's going to happen in Asia over the next 20 or 30 years. You've seen increased incidence of maritime issues in the South China Sea, you know, China establishing an air defense identification zone, the development of oil rigs in disputed territory, the creation of islands in disputed territory. 20 or 30 years from now, who is it that's going to be in the region to provide a stabilizing force for South Asia and beyond? And there's only one country, I think, that we can look forward to that will actually have the strength and power, both the economic strength and the military strength. And so we'd very much like to see India as a committed ally to the United States going forward.
Now that Modi's left the United States, you know, how would you grade the trip? I mean, it seems like it was a home run.
Close to a home run. We'll give it a triple. I think that he exceeded any past prime minister visit in terms of engagement with American executives, in terms of his engagement with the diaspora, in terms of his outreach to the American public. I think his engagement with the U.S. government, it was good, but I don't think you could say it was the best ever. You look back at 2005 and Prime Minister Singh's first visit after he became prime minister, and both in terms of flash, Prime Minister Singh was given a state dinner, the first of the Obama presidency, and also given an address to a joint session of Congress. And in substance, we had one deliverable that year, the U.S.-India nuclear deal, that clearly all other visits have been judged by ever since then. So I'll give the visit a triple. And on government, I mean, I talk about these great things, but what ultimately happened? Well, India fell a little bit short in its commitments on the nuclear deal. And the state dinner was interrupted by an uninvited guest that took all the attention afterwards, the Salahis. So even that government visit, which I think initially most people would have to judge as higher than this one in terms of substance and style, I think there's an opportunity because we start talking about a real commitment to shared issues with this joint statement. I think there's an opportunity for some good work to follow from it.
And that was Rick Rosso giving the final word on our show this week. For any questions or comments, please contact podcasts@csis.org. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.